Ann Fisher. The Minneapolis City Council on Sunday announced plans to vote to disband the police department in response to the Memorial Day death of George Floyd, a black man. Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who is white, was fired and later charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter after a smartphone video recorded him kneeling on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes while Floyd pleaded for mercy. Floyd's death has sparked ongoing demonstrations across the country, with protesters increasingly calling for swift reforms of law enforcement to help end systemic racism in the U.S. House Democrats on Monday introduced the Justice in Policing Act that, among other things, would ban chokeholds by police in the line of duty and also track reports of officer misconduct. We're talking about how things have changed in the Black Lives Matter movement. What's different this time and what reforms mean in the context of police brutality of black Americans? Hassan Kwame Jeffries is an associate professor of history at Ohio State University. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. Welcome back, Hassan Kwame Jeffries.
It's great to be with you, Ann.
As a historian, how do these ongoing protests compare with other series of protests through the decades?
Well, there certainly is a degree of consistency in the sense that you have always had these forms of protests, people taking to the streets, both nonviolently and expressing their frustration and rage against property, as we saw very early on. We've also seen similarities in terms of the police response. Very heavy-handed, especially when we look from the 1960s forward, very heavy-handed. The use of military-like gear and whatnot. But what's so there are certainly some parallels in just the optics of what we see. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing that really stands out as particularly different, though, is the demographic of the people we're seeing on the streets. In years past, it has been when it comes to these moments and movements to contesting police authority and the use of police violence, it has been overwhelmingly African-American, African-American with other marginalized groups of color. You look at Los Angeles, there was a large Latino in 1992, there was a large Latino population participation. What's so different about this moment, though, is the wide range of racial and ethnic groups, not only people of color, but of course also white people. And that high percentage, I think, makes this moment certainly unique when it comes to those aspects of these types of protests that we have seen in the past.
Why do you think that demographic change has occurred?
I think there's a number of factors going on. I think for the first time, this has been building, mm-hmm. certainly over the last 4 or 5 years. And with the advent of cell phone camera video, what has been revealed over the last few years is something that African-Americans and communities of color have known all along, that there has been a policing problem in America, a policing problem that has cost the lives of many black folk. But seeing this time after time, day after day, month after month, year after year, over the last 5 years, has contributed to taking the blinders off for many within white communities. And the tipping, you never know when a tipping point will come, but certainly there are a number of factors that led up to this moment where so many have felt so outraged by what happened to George Floyd. I don't think there's anything particularly as sad as it is to say, Ann, mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything particularly unique about George Floyd. I think what is so unique is that it comes at this moment where we have seen video after video after video, where we also see, and this is important as well, and this is part of the power of the cell phone and media behaving differently than it has in the past. Mm-hmm. We've seen the brutality of the police in suppressing nonviolent protests and demonstrations. That has also contributed significantly to the outpouring of support and the willingness of white people to join on the front lines of this protest.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what we're talking about, and that is how things have changed in the Black Lives Matter movement, in the Black civil rights movement in general, and what's different this time, what reform means in the context of police brutality of Black Americans. My guest is Hassan Kwame Jeffries, an associate professor of history at Ohio State University. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. This hour, we'd like to hear from you what you think about that question. What's different and what's different going forward from this moment? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, there's something else different as I observe, like it was maybe some years back when they legalized the U.S. Supreme Court legalized gay marriage, for instance. Big corporations were sticking their necks out on that issue in a very forceful way. And big corporations are speaking out now about this issue, like Amazon, Wendy's, Apple Music. I mean, it's all across the board. That in our society means something, does it not? Whether it's for economic, purely capitalistic reasons or not.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There is value in those public statements. And, you know, we do, as you rightly point out, we live in a capitalist society, and these are corporations, and they're driven by shareholder and stakeholder investment. But we have seen too over the last few years, and this also helps explain sort of what we're seeing both in the streets and this sort of corporate response and corporate reaction. We've seen over the last few years workers, employees of large corporations are pushing back against corporate management when it comes to their positions, their stances, and their silences on these questions of social justice. So this, you know, these corporations, in a sense, are catching up to their employees, but they're also trying to get ahead so that they don't feel that internal pushback that we've seen from various corporations, from employees among various corporations. And this isn't just sort of a Silicon Valley thing. This really is across the board.
Do you think the intersection of these most recent killings of Black Americans by police or in the name of law enforcement, as if the Ahmaud Arbery case in Georgia, the intersection of that with the pandemic has anything to do with the tipping point?
I think it does, only in the sense that for a couple of reasons, perhaps. But certainly one of the major factors is the pandemic has forced the shutdown of so much. Right. So the usual escapes are no longer available to us. You can't keep the blinders on and say, you know what, I'm just going to go to the movies. Or, you know what, you know, if the NBA finals are on, I can escape in this particular way. So there's a required focus, if you will, on what's actually happening. And so this sort of the way in which society has come to a halt has drawn the nation's attention to those aspects of society that have continued on. And one of those is racial terrorism and violence, both extra-legal, as you mentioned in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, but then also the use of excessive police force that as we saw in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
There isn't really one identified leader at the head of the movement. Unlike times past, especially when we're talking about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who speaks for protesters when you think about this? Who is at the forefront of the movement?
Well, I think even in years past, even in decades past, there have been national spokespersons. But all of these movements, even the national, what we consider to be the civil rights movement, existed as a constellation of local movements. And so I think it's critically important not for us to look for sort of one person and one voice, but to look locally. And by locally, that means for us here in Central Ohio, you know, who's in the streets in Columbus, Ohio, but then also who are organizing people on the ground in the smaller cities and suburbs and townships around, whether it's Upper Arlington or Bexley or Gahanna. All of these neighborhoods, all of these communities have local people who are organizing, who are posting. And I think we need to reach out, particularly those who are in positions of authority, whether they be in law enforcement or our elected officials. All you simply need to do is really open the blinds and look out the window and talk to the people who are in front of your office. I think there are too, and similarities in terms of what people are asking for. The broad umbrella of demands are like, look, we just want justice. Bad policing needs to stop. But then we can begin that dialogue and conversation of what we can do locally, and we're seeing it trickling up, if you will, as you were mentioning in the opening about Congress putting forward, or Democrats in Congress at least putting forward legislation to rein in policing, justice in policing, for example. So I think no national spokesperson, mm-hmm. although there are common national ideas, but we need to look locally if we want to see that local transformation while also putting pressure on those in positions of power nationally.
You know, the idea of bad policing needs to stop, that's taken on a lot of different iterations in recent days, defunding policing, dismantling it, that kind of a thing. What do we mean by bad policing needs to stop? Is it, it almost feels like it has to be a coronavirus. It has to be grab and take hold and on many different levels.
It does. It needs, what we're talking about, I think what people are talking about really is sweeping change. And I can't help, as others have begun to point to this example, and it's an important example of what happened with the police department in Camden, New Jersey. And I encourage all your listeners to sort of Google Camden Police Department.
Right.
They literally not only defunded, they disbanded their police department. It was that bad. And what they then did was build it up again from the bottom up with a different focus and emphasis, not so much about sort of reigning in criminals, if you will, but engaging with community, one-on-one foot patrols and the like. And so we have to realize that certainly over the last half century, going back to the mid-1960s, we begin to see the militarization and the modernization of American police forces that have continued to grow in size, continue to grow in sort of strength in terms of the lethalness of the weapons that they have. And it hasn't produced anything in terms of safety for people, and certainly for people of color. And so we now have these police forces that are driven by this culture that doesn't really serve the people that they're supposed to protect and serve. And so we do need not just reform within police departments, law enforcement policing, we need to reprioritize our resources so that it's, and this is really what is at the core of talking about defunding. We've been defunding social service programs. We've been defunding public schools. We've been defunding the arts. What we haven't been doing is reallocating resources away from law enforcement that clearly is ineffective in this regard and costing people their lives, and putting them in areas that can actually enhance welfare and well-being.
A reform that's often turned to at times like this, and I think this time's different, but is a recruiting and making police forces more diverse. And there's a question about whether that can ever be achieved given the current culture of policing in the United States at this time.
Well, I think you can recruit people of color, African-Americans, Latinos, and the like into police forces. And we see that in New York. New York City, NYPD, has the largest police force in the nation. It's also the most racially and ethnically diverse major metropolitan police force. But that hasn't changed the fact that they are also committing crimes against its citizens. Eric Garner, for example, and the list goes on and on. So the solution going forward isn't simply recruiting people of color into these police forces. If you want to see significant change within the police force, the presence alone of people of color won't change things. We have to have a systematic cultural shift within police departments. But then we also have to have a new understanding, reimagine what policing is itself. And until we do that, it doesn't matter how many people of color you bring in, the outcome will be the same.
We are talking about what's next and how this is different, how things have changed in the Black Lives Matter movement, what's different this time, what reform means in the context of police brutality of Black Americans. That's Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's a professor of African-American history at Ohio State. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, want to chime in, give us a call, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the ongoing protests since the police-involved death of a Minneapolis Black man, George Floyd, compare as a movement for racial justice with past eras, and whether increasing calls for swift reforms of law enforcement practices, maybe the mission of law enforcement itself could be manifest soon. Still with us is Hassan Jeffries. He's an associate professor of history at Ohio State, where he teaches about civil rights and the Black Power Movement. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. Andre Perry is a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and a scholar in residence at American University in Washington, D.C. His new book is titled Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Andre Perry, you've written that the same attitudes that cause police to devalue Black people are the same that exclude Blacks from economic opportunity. I kind of see them as inextricably linked, ultimately. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing that says a Black person doesn't belong in an economy than having an officer choke out a police officer in the middle of the street in broad daylight. The economic outcomes that we see all over the country in terms of unemployment, pay, and other evidence that shows that Black economic outcomes are lower are generated by the same attitudes, the same negative view of Black people that the officer had. Many of the corporate sector leaders, housing advocates, folks in everyday life, teachers, they also harbor the same attitudes. And so if we really want to get at why a police officer would choke out a Black man, very cavalierly, by the way, that you really have to look at who that officer is protecting, what public the officer is serving. And clearly, they're protecting the public that benefits from unjust policy, those folks who are not harassed because of it's perceived that Black people are a threat to their well-being. And so these issues are inextricably linked.
But do those people that you just referred to as benefiting from this oppression, as a white person myself, do we benefit from all of this?
I mean, one of the studies that I showed where I looked at home prices in Black majority neighborhoods and compared them to home prices in neighborhoods where the share of the black population is less than 1%. Mm-hmm. I controlled for all of those factors you see on Zillow, and I controlled for education and crime. And what we found is that black homes in black neighborhoods are valued at 23% lower than their white counterparts, amounting to about $48,000 per home. Cumulatively, there's $156 billion in lost equity. And that's the money that people use to send their kids to college, start businesses, for neighborhoods and cities to fix infrastructure, fund policing, and so forth. So individuals, black people, have much less spending power than their white counterparts. White have used that spending power mm-hmm. to bolster police forces, to bolster things in their community. So there's an enormous advantage that comes along with discrimination that we seldom talk about. And, you know, we work in the university environment. We're constantly showing disparity research between blacks and whites. The problem with that framing is that you're always casting black people as a problem, and no one invests in problems. Mm-hmm. So we only invest in people to fix problems. So you see in education is littered with white saviors for that reason. We need to uplift the assets, the strengths in black communities. And it is, when it comes to housing, for instance, housing is actually an asset, a positive asset, but it is devalued by the negative perceptions and the structural racism in this society.
And that's not debatable, absolutely. What I'm wondering is it a zero-sum game? Does it have to be, if it's equalized somehow in some miraculous way, does that mean that the other, you know, side of the equation loses something?
Well, in some respects, yes, in some respects, no. When you're talking, for instance, about merit-based scholarships across the country, largely those have been given to white, middle-class, upper-middle-class people. If we really had a racial equity lens, that money that goes to scholarships would go to people who actually need it, not to people who can afford it. Mm-hmm. And so... yes, in that respect, certainly there is a, you know, only so many slices to the pie.
Okay.
And we've got to figure out how to distribute those equally. But I will say that we don't really understand how much the economy can grow overall if we had a more inclusion at the end of the day. We're missing out on revenues and productivity and innovation, because we're essentially locking out black people from particular aspects of the economy.
And, you know, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, certainly chime in here. I mean, this goes to the issue of funding for police as well. We focus so much attention on policing and take, as you mentioned earlier, shifting these funds, which are relatively finite, from other agencies that could be raising people up.
No, exactly. I think Brother Perry really hit the nail on the head when he said one of the things that would be lost are these unfair privileges that whites have benefited from that African Americans have not had the advantage of being able to take advantage of. One of the things, but that being said, I think this is much more than just sort of a zero sum. Because what we're really talking about are taking resources and reallocating them and investing them in communities that have historically and continue to be marginalized. And once you invest these resources in these communities, you don't just get a dollar return. You just don't get an economic return. What you get is an improvement in human capital. And there ought not be a price tag on that. And once we tap into, once we improve, once we invest, and get that return on human capital, then the whole society benefits. And I think that's really where our attention needs to be, that everyone, not only the community that receives the investment, but the broader community as a whole benefits when we take the time, when we reprioritize and reallocate our resources so that everyone has this opportunity and chance to live up to their human potential.
And Hassan, can I just add one thing to that, just to put an exclamation point on it? The criminal justice system is a wealth extractor. I mean, it takes a large sum of money, energy, resources out of Black communities. And so every time we imprison someone, every time we incarcerate someone, every time we charge people silly fines and fees for nonviolent offenses, you're taking money out of the Black community we desperately need. So it's not just a sort of a gaining of advantage on the white side. It is truly a wealth extractor in Black communities.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about how the ongoing protests since the police-involved death of a Minneapolis Black man, George Floyd, compare as a movement for racial justice with past eras. What's different this time? Whether increasing calls for swift reforms of law enforcement practices, maybe dismantling police departments, whether that could have an impact going forward. My guest, you just heard Andre Perry. He's a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institute and a scholar in institution and a scholar in residence at the American University in Washington. His new book is titled Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. Still with us, Hassan Jeffries as well, associate professor of history at Ohio State, where he teaches about the civil rights and Black power movement. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Washington Post reported recently, and this isn't necessarily a surprise, but that the economic divide between Blacks and whites is as wide as it was in 1968. And a lot of that has to do with the rebound factor from the Great Recession. Andre Perry, how does this go to resources that are used to police Americans these days? How does that play out at that point?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I demonstrate in my new book, Know Your Price, is I show how wealth begets wealth. And in addition, how the devaluation of Black assets makes Blacks more vulnerable to the inevitable economic shocks that occur. You know, that number, that $156 billion, that is essentially lost because of racism, really shows up when a recession hits and you have to shut down your business for a few weeks or some other emergency happens. Black people simply do not have the backup, the cushion to withstand the economic shocks because of the devaluation of housing alone. But then you combine that with cities that are piling on money for a criminal justice system, you create a very toxic soup in which we are creating an economy that's partially built on punishing Black people. And you saw that in Ferguson, where lots of people were essentially funding municipal government because of probation fees and court costs. And it was essentially a money generator. And so you just had to feed that beast by constantly surveilling, punishing, harassing Black people. And then on top of that, there's a political angle. When you have more wealth, you can actually put money into political campaigns for people who will create policies based on your interests. Right now, the Black community doesn't have the discretionary wealth to promote politicians who will defund the police. And so it is a spiraling sort of a downward spiral when you devalue Black assets. you just create a lack of resources and protection that shows up particularly in times of crisis.
In Hassan Kwame Jeffries, this is this institutionalization, this endemic racism that we're all talking about, right?
It is, because too often we like to, or we pretend that the principal problem that Black folk are facing is personal prejudice. It's the racist action or the racist actor, or it's the one bad cop, but it's not. Brother Perry just laid out quite mm-hmm. wonderfully really how systemic and how deeply embedded the problems that Black folk are facing. And it isn't just sort of the actions of one rogue actor. It's really how we have structured our society. I mean, you know, we talk about, we have a person in the White House who likes to talk about, or used to like to talk about, sort of job creation on the part of African-Americans and unemployment levels. Well, you know, he's talking about income at most. He's not talking about wealth. And wealth, of course, is that gap is continuing to grow. And as Brother Perry just pointed out, that really limits the things not only individually that Black folk can do, but collectively that they can do. For so long, Black communities, just like Ferguson and in Baltimore, they have been preyed upon, certainly as we have disinvested in municipal services. They have been preyed upon through a particular kind of policing that really extracts wealth, the bit that does exist in the Black community, and makes it even harder to do the things that these communities need to do to survive and to thrive. So it absolutely, we have to deal with sort of individual examples of personal prejudice, but in all of our aspects of society, whether it's in education, policing, government, banking and finance, we have to look at and deconstruct the ways that we have set up these systems to work against African Americans and people of color.
You know, Pete, when you say the thing set up, I mean, it's hard for people to grasp that somebody's done something consciously and that it didn't just erode into this. Yeah, Andre Perry?
Oh, man, but let's be clear. Mm-hmm. There is policy violence that happens to Black Americans every day. Now, I mean, I talk a lot about housing and business structures. But let's be clear that the Homeowners Loan Corporation in the 30s essentially said, hey, these areas are too risky for us to invest in.
Right.
And we can't allow them into other areas of the city. We're not going to give them ability to create wealth. We're going to stymie their economic growth. And that's an act of violence. That is purposeful. And yet it enabled generations of white people to acquire wealth and denied Black people the ability to protect themselves. And so it was purposeful. Our inability to stop this is also purposeful. We do not have the political will to change the systems we know are broken. It's an easy argument to make that Black people aren't getting the return on investment from police. It is an easy argument to make. People don't understand how hard it is for Black Americans to get justice. I mean, and obviously the killing of George Floyd, we want quality policing, but the inability to incarcerate police officers show you that we're not getting our return on investment. And so we need policies that actually work for Black people and to deconstruct those policies that were deliberately causing harm to Black communities.
We're going to continue our conversation. That's Andre Perry. He's a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and author of a new book called Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. Also with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at Ohio State University. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We will get to the calls that are waiting when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The ongoing and widespread protests against racial injustice by police have many participants and observers asking whether something has changed, whether the nation has turned a corner on addressing police brutality of Black Americans and the larger state of systemic racism in the U.S. Still with us, Andre Perry. He's a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and a scholar in residence at American University. His new book is titled Know Your Price: Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. Also, Hassan Jeffries, he's an associate professor of history at Ohio State, where he teaches about civil rights and the Black Power Movement. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's jump off from where Andre Perry stopped before we took a break. Hassan Kwame Jeffries, the idea of dismantling or deconstructing our law enforcement organizations around the country. You mentioned earlier in the program before Andre joined us that this really has to be done at a local level. You mentioned Camden, New Jersey, to wit. They're talking about it in Minneapolis and in other places, and people ask, are they really talking about defunding? Are they really talking about dismantling? And what does that mean?
Well, look, in the United States, and certainly we've seen it growing over the last half century, we are simply over-policed. We've been pouring, for political reasons and political purposes, more and more money, literally billions of dollars, into policing, military equipment, giving to, you know, these local police districts that have no need for it whatsoever. And so what people are saying, what I'm saying, what many others are saying is, if it's not working, if it hasn't been working, then we need to stop doing what we're doing, reimagine and reinvest. Andre put it beautifully. He's like, look, Black folk, and not just Black folk, communities of color, and not just communities of color, really all Americans are not receiving the return on the investment that they're making in law enforcement. And so it's a fool's errand to continue to pour the amount of money that we are into criminal justice, into law enforcement, if it's not making the society better. You know, we're actually asking police, if you will, to do more than what they signed up for, right? To do social service work, to do work with schools. They don't need to be doing that stuff. And so we need to reprioritize where we are investing our funds. Nobody is saying, the vast majority of people are saying, listen, no one wants to live in a society without law and order, to use that term. Mm-hmm. Nobody's saying police disappear forever, but I don't need to see a cop every three steps. I don't need to see a police officer in a car every time I step out of my house. We are over-policed, and we can live in a society that is safe, that benefits everyone, without the same level of financial and resource investment that we currently have.
Well, you're over-policed, but you're under-policed when you need it.
Well, you did. That's a part of the problem too, right? You're over-policed, and the amount of policing that you have actually doesn't do the job that you would hope that they would do. And so that's the point. If we're pouring all these resources into policing and we're not actually getting the kind of policing that actually helps people, but in fact makes things worse, is putting people's lives at risk, then we will be crazy not to rethink what we have created.
Okay, I want to get to some calls in response to what you both have been talking about. Joanne in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. You know, in all the talk I've heard for days and days and days about dismantling and defunding, mm-hmm. I've never heard anyone really discuss the fact that that police officer who killed Floyd had 18 complaints. He had already been on trial in 2006 for a shooting. why was he allowed to be on the police force and made a training officer? Right. To me, that's the problem. Those type of policemen and that doing that is the problem.
Okay. Joanne, Andre Perry?
Yeah, I mean, the caller is right in this regard that there's no way that that cop should have been or that person should have been a cop. And this is the issue. It's about quality policing, that we're not getting quality policing investment that we're putting in. And police unions are they work for on behalf of police officers. And we know that police forces across the country have been shelters for white supremacists, folks who have an axe to grind against Black Americans, and the police unions help protect the people in those in various departments across the country. And so we need reform that allows us to be able to sue police officers who use unnecessary force. We need an accountability system that puts them in some type of database so that we know that we have a crooked cop in our midst. There's lots of things we can do on that front, but the caller is right. That person, and I should remember his name, he should not have been a cop because he had such a horrible track record in terms of quality.
His name is Derek Chauvin. He is facing charges of third-degree murder and manslaughter for the death of George Floyd on Memorial Day. Yeah.
And if I could add something, you know, a lot of people talk about sort of bad apples, right? So there was just one or two bad cops. And well, certainly we need to prosecute police. We do a terrible job of that. We provide them this qualified immunity. We don't prosecute police. Mm-hmm. That would take those individuals out. But this is why we also need to be thinking about this more systematically and also thinking about the culture of policing. Bad police police badly, but bad police also make good police police badly. And we saw that play out in Minnesota, mm-hmm. where you have three mm-hmm. other cops who were sitting around and are not intervening. And so this is partly the culture of policing that we have created. It's reinforced, as Andre was saying, by these police unions whose job is to defend police no matter what. And so it's not just about the individual actor, because if we remove the individual actor but don't change the culture within these police departments, then we're going to produce the same outcome.
Let's see. Machumu in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I'm concerned that I don't hear people talk about white male studies that leads to the will from which we make the various choices we make. The white male studies is the root of the problem because that's where the mindset is developed. The things of value of people of color and women are not included properly in the development of the mind.
Mm-hmm. Can I respond to
Andre,
that?
Andre Perry, of course.
Yeah, we do not talk about whiteness enough. We have explored the different nuances and corners of blackness and black activism, and rightfully so. It's been a powerful force in this country. But we often give whiteness short shrift in a sense that we don't study enough about white masculinity and its impact on public policy. I mean, if you were a Martian and you just landed here in the United States, and you go, we have not had a woman president ever. You would go, what is going on here? More than 50% of the population, women throughout society, represented advancement and all these other things. And yet, when you look in the halls of Congress, it's overwhelmingly white male. There is something about power control and subjugation that is braided up with white male identity that we need to explore, unpack, and deconstruct, because it is harming everyone, all of these negative impacts.
Hmm. Hassan?
Yeah, the problems that Black folk face are very much rooted in a deeply ingrained belief in white supremacy. And that extends back to slavery and earlier. But Andre's right, like white men need to get it together. But we're not gonna let white women off the hook either.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They're also benefiting and helping to perpetuate white supremacy. And so we do need to focus our attention not only on sort of the disparities, right, which are problematic, but the root of the problem, which is we live in a society that still embraces consciously and unconsciously white supremacy, and that absolutely has to be dealt with. And that's a problem in the white community that we need to focus attention on.
And, you know, we've talked about this before, how much that has to do with the fact that for 400 plus years now, we have not had a reckoning, an emotional reckoning in this country of the history of slavery and the enslavement of human beings. We've had the civil rights movement. We've had these sort of things on paper. But at an emotional level, we're still in la-la land.
Emotionally, but then also intellectually.
Yeah.
With the deficits in wealth and these wealth gaps, I mean, that ties back to slavery and then Jim Crow and systemic discrimination following it. So you're right. We need some truth and reconciliation. But before we can have that reconciliation, we got to have some truth and then follow it up with reform after that.
Yeah. Andre Perry.
But I just wanted to add, we've had opportunities to do so. I mean, Hassan has written about these moments in time where the nation has been captivated by a series of events that crescendos to some horrific event. And we've had other opportunities for this. And we're in a moment right now where we need to make decisions. And I love the Defund the Police movement because it's forcing us to reprioritize in ways that we have not, forcing us to look at policy in ways in which we have not. And so I think we're in another period where we, again, have an opportunity to reckon with the past. But just like the previous opportunities, there is that chance we can sidestep the hard work of improving our society.
So in the short term, we only have about a minute left, but people are afraid of this talk of dismantling Hassan Kwame Jeffries, and does it have to happen quickly? What do we mean by that?
No, I think we can't be afraid of semantics, of the language and the words. I think we have to look at the policies and what people are demanding and asking and needing. And yes, it has to happen quickly. It has to happen immediately. It has to happen now because people are losing their lives. We have waited far too long. Patience isn't going to fix the problem. And so we need to address this. We need to address it immediately. We need to address it nationally, but then we also need to address it locally. And it's only about comfort and convenience if you say, hey, let's slow down. Mm-hmm. No, we need to move forward so we can save lives moving forward.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, professor of African American history at Ohio State University. His new book is titled Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. Thank you, as always, Hassan, for joining us today.
Thank you for this conversation, Ann.
Andre Perry, thank you as well. I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Andre Perry is a fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and author of a new book titled Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. That's it for now. Ongoing conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.